you know about the true crimes that inspired a Bruce Springsteen album? Or the murders AC/DC was blamed for? How about Taylor Swift's violent stalkers? Or the suspicious deaths of Brittany Murphy and River Phoenix? These stories and more are told in the Disgraceland podcast, hosted by me, Jake Brennan, every Tuesday, where I dive deep into subjects from the dark side of music history and entertainment. So follow and listen to Disgraceland on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Clay, good morning. How you doing?
I'm doing great, fellas. It's good to be down here in Mobile, Alabama. I mean, it's in the south. It's actually sunny down here. It was 65 degrees. I got a little bit of a sunburn.
Well, so you know, I'm warm here too, Clay. It's about 40 here too, so we're getting the sunlight here. So you're not like you're escaping the polar vortex, but it is nice that they have good weather down there. So what did you do yesterday? What are you looking for? Ryan Poles arrived. We made a big deal about where he was the first day. He gets down there. We know the Bears are looking for a little bit of everything. What did you focus on yesterday?
You guys already know what I focused on. I focused on what the Bears need to be focused on, and that's the trenches. Mm-hmm. And that's honestly all I've really watched. I mean, obviously some skill guys have popped too, but I just focused on the trenches. And, I mean, there are some players down here. I think this is one of the – I've been to the last three Senior Bowls, and I have to say this is the best group of O-line, D-line that I've seen since I've been down here. And you know the Bears look for guys at the Senior Bowl. You go back to Braxton Jones, he was the Senior Bowl guy, Dominic Robinson, Darnell Wright, Tyreek Stevenson, Zach Pickens, Roschon Johnson, Kieran Amagaji, and David's favorite player, Torrey Taylor, Bajan as well. So you know they're down here looking, and the trenches are looking good.
You know, it's interesting because I read yesterday, and I guess I knew this, but it was something I hadn't seen, that Ryan Poles has drafted at least two players out of the Senior Bowl since he's taken over the Bears. And I agree with what you're saying. Now, a lot of really good players are at the Senior Bowl. It's the best of the bowl games, the postseason All-Star games. I guess when I think about kind of where the Bears are at, you know, looking, I don't know who it was, maybe CBS dropped their top 50 players and they only had 9 offensive linemen among those 50. Usually there are more. Is this a draft, generally speaking, where there's more depth on the offensive line, or it doesn't seem like it's top heavy? And I'm wondering, if you believe, and I'm with you totally, it's got to be the trenches. Do you believe they go more defensive line in the first round, or do they, you know, they got 2 second-round picks, high second-round picks. Do they wait till then? And how many linemen do they need out of this draft on each side of the ball?
After being down here, I'm confident that there will be a good number of picks available on the offensive line at 39 and 41. So I would be good with them going D-line with that first pick at number 10, because there is some depth. There's a couple guys that I really fell in love with that I think will still be available in those 2 second-round pick spots that could be guys you could literally plug in, an interior lineman. And the good thing about the interior lineman, because the Bears, they do have a little bit of wiggle room, obviously left tackle. Some people say upgrade, some people say don't. But a lot of times these interior linemen will fall into the second, you know, third round because they're not looked at as a priority. That's obviously changing a little bit. But I think that this class is really strong with a bunch of interior linemen in that second to third round range. And you got a lot of guys that have transferred from tackle to guard, even out here in Mobile, and have looked so much better. And they look like pro players. The first thing I look for when I'm out here is I go, is this guy an NFL football player? And then after that, I go, okay, what's this guy need to work on? What does this guy do well? And then that's kind of how I make my judgments on if I think he's a player or not.
And so, Clay, I referred to the Senior Bowl earlier in the show. That's where the rank-and-file players of the NFL draft go to. They get observed and they make their impressions. And I just wonder, when you see all the traits you just described, those are great. But I wonder if you could relate to or can identify guys who just have that certain sort of, whether it's a hunger, whether it's a mentality. You know, you came out of Missouri State. You were drafted in the 4th round, and you spent 7 years in the NFL. Maybe because you always felt like you were trying to prove something because of where you were drafted or where you came from. How many guys like that have you seen, and how common is that mentality at the Senior Bowl?
Oh, it's huge. And David, don't steal one of my years. I played 8 years, man. They're going to take away my pension now because of you. But I always look for that. I look for the small school guys because a lot of times you don't know how they're going to play when they're going against a guy that has LSU or Florida on his helmet. I played the East-West Shrine game when I was coming out, and that was a big game for me, showing that I could play with this different competition level. And there's a number of guys that I like that are smaller school guys. Obviously, you see it less and less with the portal. But you look at the past years. I remember Quinyon Mitchell out here just showing out. Ladd McConkey, a guy that rose. Ricky Pearsall going to last year. There was a number of guys that came out here and were overlooked, and you just saw how competitive they were, taking every rep, going out there winning rep after rep. And then you see these guys go high in the draft, and then you see them have success in the NFL. That's why I love coming out here every year, because it's translatable, because you can see the guys that are first in line with every drill, but aren't scared to go up against the top guy. And that's the guys that you see success.
I'm curious. So, you know, you obviously – Jacksonville, one of your teams, you know what that's like there. You could probably yell the word Duval a lot better than Liam Cohen managed. I'm curious, tell us about Press Taylor. Do you like that hire? He is a former OC down there. I don't know that he can yell Duval right, but he you know, is a passing game coordinator, so it's not the same job. But what's your take on him?
You know, I like Press Taylor as a human. He was in Philly with me when I was there. He was, you know, Doug Peterson obviously came from Philly to Jacksonville. And then in Jacksonville, I spent some time down there going to training camps and hanging out with those guys. And he's an excellent human, and he's a guy that's going to work his tail off. But he just did not have a lot of success in Jacksonville. If you ask any Jacksonville Jaguar fan, they do not like Press Taylor. The big controversy down there is, why is Doug Peterson letting Press Taylor call plays? Everybody thought Doug Peterson should have called plays. First, Doug's not saying who's calling plays. Then you find out that Press is calling plays. Then maybe Doug's calling plays, and it's this big controversy, and it obviously didn't add up to success for Trevor Lawrence. I think he's a smart guy. He's been around ball. He's been around a number of quarterbacks, but for whatever reason, in Jacksonville, he was given the opportunity and he didn't have success when he was taking the reins. But I think he's obviously in a different position here. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have to call plays, and I think he'll be a much better coach when he takes that off his plate. He just focuses strictly on the passing game and helping out any way he can with Caleb.
So, Clay, we're talking about the Bears looking for an offensive line coach still. That's the one position and maybe the most important position that remains unfilled on the coaching staff. They're looking at Justin Fry at Ohio State, Dan Rouchard at Tulane, who has some NFL experience. So looking at Notre Dame's offensive line coach, from your perspective, knowing what these practices are like and how maybe, you know, the game is changing, what are the advantages or maybe the pros and cons of going to the college ranks to find your offensive line coach for a team like the Bears?
I think it's a guy that will bring a fresh perspective, a guy that's malleable, a guy that you can kind of teach with, and a guy that's really going to be receptive to the way you want to do things. Because a lot of these offensive linemen, offensive line coaches, I mean, they have their own way of doing things. They have their mind made up. So it's kind of tough when you come from a new system and you want to teach things a certain way to find an offensive line coach that's going to be able to coach the outside zone the way you want to coach it, to coach the gap scheme the way you want to coach it, to coach the pin and pull blocks the way you want to coach it, to have the same thoughts of protection as you do. So when you go for a college coach, I think there's a little bit more of an opportunity to sit in the room with them and kind of come up with a plan, because these guys, these offensive line coaches are different. I mean, it's a tough job. I think it's obviously outside the offensive coordinator, it's absolutely the most difficult and the most important job on offense. And it's very difficult. And if you don't have a cohesiveness between the offensive coordinator and the offensive line coach, you know, things can get a little messy because now they're seeing things a different way.
Yeah, it's a crucial job, especially here, especially this year, right? Because you got to get a teacher in here because there's player development needed. And you got to get, as you're saying, you got to draft some guys here. I've been waiting for this hire as much as anybody on staff. I was really hoping that Fraley would follow him here, but that's not happening. So you got to move on. And, you know, these guys all have careers and they all have reasons to like him. And I, as a general group, I love offensive line coaches.
Oh, yeah. They're usually guys with a big personality, and they have such a – there's been some rumors floating around at the Senior Bowl that the Bears have found their offensive line coach. I don't know who this is really coming from, but I think these guys are so important because they have to command such a big room. And you're talking obviously five guys on the field at one time. There's no other position that has to deal with that. An interior offensive line center is so different than an offensive tackle, the way you set, the way you run block, the pin and pulls, and getting these guys to act together. It's such an important position. You definitely want to see that get taken care of quickly so you can start getting to work and start figuring out the way you want to teach these techniques, because it's not an easy lift when you're out there and you're trying to figure out exactly how you're going to coach some of these schemes.
Talking with Clay Harbor, who is my colleague at the Chicago Sports Network down at the Senior Bowl, evaluating talent, looking forward to another day of practice. So, Clay, take us into the meeting room the first time that Declan Doyle addresses the offense. The Declan Doyle, the offensive coordinator, who's 28 years old. DJ Moore turns 28 in April. I just wonder, how big of a challenge is that for a 28-year-old offensive coordinator to command the respect that, you know, you expect an offensive coordinator to have?
You know, it's a different time now, and you've seen some success with some guys like Kevin O'Connell and obviously Sean McVay, some young guys, but, you know, it's different. It's different having a guy that is literally your peer in your age group. I've never experienced it. You know, I've had some offensive coordinators going from Marty Mordenweg when I was in Philly, you know, Jacksonville. We had Greg Olson, Ole out there. And then go to the Saints. You got Sean Payton, who's basically the offensive coordinator. I mean, it's just different. We go to the Patriots, and we have Josh McDaniels, our offensive coordinator. So those are guys that have done it and have obviously commanded the room before, and are a little bit older, a little bit your senior. I've never experienced a guy that I'm older than telling me what to do as an offensive coordinator. I think obviously these guys are professionals, and he's going to be a whiz kid on the computer and the analytics and all that. And, you know, I don't know if Ben's not going to be doing a lot of the teaching in there on his own, but at some point Declan Doyle is going to have to step up and get in front of that room and do some of the install. So that's interesting when you do have a guy his age in that position. I don't know that I've ever seen that before in my experience, but I think these guys are pros, and what you have in Chicago is a group of young guys mixed with some veterans, and these guys all want to learn, and you got the guys with the right type of mindset. So I think it'll be fine, but it definitely is different.
Is Dan Rauscher the name you heard of the O-line coach in waiting? Or they interviewed Justin Fry yesterday. They've talked about the Notre Dame guy. But I think Rauscher might be the guy you're talking about.
Dan Rauscher, he's been floating around down here. And, I mean, obviously, I don't have it on good authority, but some of the local Chicago guys talking out here say they've heard it, that he is going to be the next offensive line coach, but don't quote me on that.
Yeah,
just a rumor floating around in Mobile.
That's okay, Clay. Nobody's listening.
it's just us talking.
How about the quarterbacks? What quarterbacks are you keeping an eye on? I know the Bears aren't in the market for a quarterback, but certainly the Senior Bowl's week for a lot of quarterbacks, they can take a leap. I think Riley Leonard is there, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Let me give you some of my players here. The Riley Leonard has had an up and down week. Jalen Milroe has had an up and down week, but Dart, I think, is the guy that's impressed me. He's been pretty accurate. I think he's a guy that's moving up draft boards. Dylan Gabriel, he's got an absolute cannon. He's small, but he's got an absolute cannon. I think they say he threw a ball like 75 miles an hour, which is pretty impressive. But I got the perfect guy for the Chicago Bears, man. And this guy's from North Dakota State. And I covered him, actually, when I called games for the Missouri Valley Conference and David's alma mater, Ball State, and I do some Mid-America Conference stuff. But this guy, Gray Zabel, he was a tackle in college. He played right and left tackle. And he comes out here, and he moves to guard. North Dakota State product. Oh. And he starts playing guard and center. And I'm not kidding. I don't think this guy has lost a rep all week, and he's a guy I could see. He was talked about as a third, fourth round guy. I think he's climbed up into the second round, but he reminds me of Grant Barton, Cody Mock. So just remember that name, Gray Zabel. And then hear me out on this. I know this is pretty crazy, but there is a 5'10 center, 270 pounds, and this guy is just destroying people. Yeah, Mike Tomlin salivated. He was a state championship record, state championship wrestler. And Willie Lampkin, I mean, this guy from North Carolina, he's 5'10", 270. I don't know how you guys would feel about having a 5'10 center, but he is
hey, Caleb could see over him.
He can see over him. I'm telling you, it's the strangest thing I've ever seen. This guy's 5'10". He's going up against a guy that's 6'8", and he's winning the rep.
That's awesome.
He's just so good at leveraging. It's impressive. Running back Trevor Etienne,
yeah.
He's 5'8", but he is a guy that can catch, that can run. Kez Johnson at wide receiver is just, he can't be guarded. Jake Beck, a guy that's been doing unbelievable out here. Then my edge rusher for you guys, I love Mike Green. He led the FBS with 17 sacks. He's 6'3", 6'4", 250, played well against Ohio State, and he was just bulldozing guys out here. The last guy I have was Texas A&M's edge rusher, Shamar Stewart. I mean, this guy, I think he went from third round to possible first round pick. So there's a lot of guys in the trenches that have really helped their stock out here. And I think it's going to be, it's a good draft. And I know people weren't saying that, but I think it's a good draft for O-line, D-line, and Ryan Poles will hopefully get it right this year.
That's great information, Clay. Before we let you go, I need a ruling here. So we had some fun at your expense on the Big Pro Football Show. What is your philosophy when wearing your former jersey, number 82, to Eagles events or when in Philadelphia? Because we got a picture of you actually having your 82 jersey on eating lunch.
No, wait. You guys didn't show that
they
on the show,
showed
though,
that on TV. I was watching it. And David even teased that you'd be on today, and I was thinking – you look like, first of all, and this is a compliment, Clay, you look like you got the pads on when you're just wearing the jersey. You look like you're ready to play. But I mean, yeah, it looked like it was game-worn. I mean, it looked like it was pretty beat up.
Yeah, it was a game-worn jersey, but that was the only gear I had. It's the conference championship here. You know, all I have is my jersey. Yeah, I'm going to go out and support my guys. And the thing was, I wasn't even in Philly. I was in Toronto.
Okay.
Nobody's going to realize this is my cousin's 30th birthday. We went out to Toronto. We're at a sports bar. I go, who the heck would even know who the heck I am that I play for the Eagles out there? And then, yeah, I see this picture floating around. I didn't know you guys got me like that yesterday. So that's a low blow, David.
Looking good, though, Clay. I'm all for that. I think you're wearing the colors. I support that you support your team.
Yeah, I got the Eagles obviously winning this one. I think surprise Vic Fangio.
Yeah,
you know, Vic Fangio's been calling a heck of a defense this year, and I think he's going to do enough for the Eagles defense so that Saquon and Jalen and the boys can pull this one out.
Good stuff, Clay.
Great stuff, Clay. Thanks a ton.
Safe travels.
Thanks, guys.
That's Clay Harper.
We will rally around Kurt Warner.
Kurt Warner.
You're a big horse, and you must be ridden every Monday night.
Two-time NFL MVP.
They talk about this, the greatest show on turf, maybe the best offense ever in football.
Super Bowl champion.
Warner to throw. Going deep downfield. Adjusting for it is Isaac Bruce. Touchdown. 73 yards.
Pro Football Hall of Famer.
Not just the NFL Hall of Fame. And I wear that as a badge of honor because without pro football, in all its forms and fashions, I'm not here tonight.
Radio analyst for Westwood One Sports.
Touchdown, Saquon Barkley! He is incredible!
What you can do in 18 plays, we can do in one. That is the way the Eagles are built in their run game. They have a home run hitter at the running back position, and he can go the distance at any point in time.
NFL Network analyst.
Do you have a doomsday folder in case someone wanted to interview you to be a head coach?
I do not have a folder.
Kurt Warner with Spiegel and Holmes on 670 The Score.
Fantastic to be able to talk with our friend Kurt Warner. He joins us now on the Circa Resort and Casino Hotline, CircaLasVegas.com. Kurt, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
You got it. Been a while, guys, but good to talk to you.
Yeah, man. And, you know, heard a lot of you on the broadcast doing the Eagles and the Commanders. And we were like, man, that guy, he knows quarterbacking. He knows the NFL. And we have an official head coach in Ben Johnson. So let's get to all of it. First off, that Eagles offense doesn't seem very stoppable right now to me. Why is it working so well, what they have?
Well, I mean, I think it starts with the players. It starts with talent. They've got talent all over their offense. It's pick your poison because they've got arguably the best offensive line in football, maybe them in Detroit. You could go back and forth. Really athletic up front. Of course, they've got, as you just heard there, the home run hitter, maybe the best back in the National Football League in Saquon Barkley. And what does make them different? Is they do get big plays in the run game. You know, unlike a lot of teams that use the run to set up big plays in the pass game, they're a team that can get big plays and do get big plays. I mean, nobody had more big plays in the NFL this year than Saquon Barkley. And obviously most of them were when you're handing the ball off to him and he's got that breakaway speed. So it starts there. Is they're so good there and so good at the running back spot. You have a threat to run and do some things in Jalen Hurts, but they've also got playmakers on the outside that if you want to stack the box against them and you give A.J. Brown one-on-one, I mean, what cornerback in the league is stopping him one-on-one? And then complementary pieces are good on the outside as well. So it all starts up front, the ability to protect Jalen Hurts, the ability to create holes for Saquon Barkley, and then everything else is just basically – you got to pick your poison. There's nothing that you could go in and say, hey, if we just stop this, they can't beat us. That's not the case with this Eagles team, and that's what always makes it tough. You know, every time you go into a big game, you talk to anybody. It doesn't matter how good the quarterback is. Doesn't matter how good the running back is. They always say, we got to make them one-dimensional. We've got to stop something and hope that then we can – you know, do what we do and force them to go away from their strength or force them to have to do something to beat us. And that's our best chance. And with this team, I just don't know. Yeah, obviously you want to take away Saquon Barkley and you want to take away the run game, but they just have the capabilities of beating you both ways. They're really good at doing a lot of different things. And it's what's going to make it a challenge for this Chiefs defense.
I'm a fan of Jalen Hurts. And I still have a really hard time like assessing his value as a quarterback. How do you look at him and say, this is what he is, this is what he can do, and this is how he could win?
Well, I mean, I think the thing with Jalen, and here's the thing with most quarterbacks in the league, that they're not great at everything. But you have to be great at enough things. And that's who Jalen Hurts is. He's great at enough things. You know, there's times he holds on to the ball too long. There's times when there's opportunities in front of him and he doesn't throw it or he doesn't see it. You know, so that's the thing that when you hear a lot of, you know, analysts talk, like that's the frustrating part. Because I know he's capable of doing those things physically, like making those throws. But when you don't see it and when you miss an easy opportunity in front of him, you're like, ah, he got to be better in that area. And he probably does. He's got a lot of room to grow in that area. But there's so many other things that he does that even oftentimes when he holds the football, it doesn't become a negative play. That he might hold it and he might miss a shot down the field, but he turns it into a six-yard gain because he buys time and he's athletic enough and he makes a play. He might miss the blitz. And so I was just looking at the blitz tape because I think it's going to be key in the Super Bowl. But they had a free runner come at him, you know, down in the red zone last week with Washington. And, you know, he's running around crazy back there and runs about 10 yards deep. But then that's the one he flips up to Devontae Smith and they get the PI and sets him up on the 1 yard line. So he's got the ability to make up for some of the deficiencies. And then, you know, he's a really good thrower of the football. If he knows where he wants to go with it, as we saw on that 4th and 5 that he dropped right on top of A.J. Brown, like a handoff, 40 yards down the field that really turned that game. He's got the ability to run the quarterback draw. And we saw him score 2 touchdowns, although one was called back in the game on the quarterback draw. So the RPO game. You know, Patrick Mahomes is the best in the league at that. But I also think Jalen Hurts is one of the better guys in the league at, you know, at pulling it and getting out on the edge and seeing guys and making plays. So there's just so many things that he does well, although he doesn't do everything great and there's areas he can improve. He's got a number of things that he does really, really well, and it complements what they want to do and what they're able to do because of their run game and what they have up front. That's why he wins. You know, sometimes he doesn't take a chance with a football and he just pulls it down and turns it into a 4 or 5 yard gain. And he's willing to live with that, where other quarterbacks are always trying to make that play. And I think it's one of the reasons that he's such a great winner is my team's good. We can win on defense. We can win running the football. We don't have to win with me throwing 300 yards a game, although I can. We don't have to win that way. So I can be smarter and maybe a little more conservative with the football, and that's okay because we've got the formula that allows me to do it. And then, as we saw in the last Super Bowl between these two teams, he can also throw for 300 yards. Or as we saw in the championship game, thought he, you know, threw the ball extremely well in that game, made good decisions, pushed the ball down the field when he needed to. So the capabilities are there. He's just happy to do, as he always says, do what I have to do for us to be successful.
Kurt Warner with us here on Spiegel and Holmes on 670 The Score. Kurt, your former offensive coordinator, Mike Martz, was on this show the day that the Bears hired Ben Johnson. Before Ben Johnson spoke, we reached out to Mike Martz, and he was terrific in talking about Ben, a guy he got to know when Mike did a visit down to Miami when Ben was an assistant. And Ben was clearly really smart and asked a lot of good questions, and they kept a relationship. And Mike Martz is a fan of Ben Johnson. Here's your former offensive coordinator, Mike Martz, talking about the Bears' new head coach.
Very smart, very, very passionate. I just think that he's a superstar. You know, I think it's been coming for a long time, but he's prepared for this. I don't know if I've seen anybody call a game better than him.
Have you ever talked about Ben Johnson with Mike Martz is the first question. Has that come up?
No, we have not talked about Ben, no.
Okay. But do you share Mike's
admiration
for Ben Johnson as a play caller and offensive designer in the NFL?
Yeah, I really like what he does. You know, the one caveat I think with all of it is that they also had the pieces to be able to do it, and a lot of different kinds of pieces. But I thought Ben was really good. I mean, I like his scheme. I like the way he sets it up. You know, we've talked a lot about pure progression on here, and he does a number of pure progression type plays, but he builds in a lot of the defender read stuff that I love to connect with the pure progression. So he's got, you know, different concepts within the pure progression that fit in putting defenders in conflict in certain ways. So, you know, his ability to be creative is, you know, that was one thing that I thought Mike was great at when we played, when I played for him, was he was very creative and he would try things out of the box and he would throw new things at the defense every single week. You see that same stuff with Ben Johnson, is that every week there was something. I mean, they got offensive tackles, you know, throwing passes, and they've got, you know, hook and lateral type plays, you know, every other week. I mean, just all kinds of creative stuff that they would do. So I am a big fan of, you know, what he does from an offensive coordinating standpoint.
With Caleb Williams, and Ben kind of mentioned this in his opening press conference, he was talking directly to Caleb at the time, which I thought was great, is he was saying that he wants to break this thing all the way down and start building a new offense with Caleb, and said, look, we've got to spend time together. We've got to get in a room and watch film together to figure out what each person likes. So if you go from having a season in the league and now you got to kind of start over with someone who has a different vision for who you are and what you are as a quarterback, how should Caleb embrace this? What are the things that you hope Ben Johnson works with him and builds him back up to being, I think, the prospect that all of us are excited about?
Well, I mean, yeah, I think, you know, for me, when I think about quarterbacks, I think about all quarterbacks seeing the game differently.
And so, you know, I always kind of use the analogy that you could take three Hall of Fame quarterbacks and you could draw a play up on the board and one would just love it. Like, oh my gosh, call that 10 times a game. The next guy would be like, oh, I like that. That's a good play. I can work with that. And then you might have a third that goes, I hate that play. I don't like it. And it's the exact same play. And every detail is the exact same play, but each quarterback kind of sees the game differently. And so another analogy for that is I was in the West Coast system for just a short period of time in Green Bay, and I hated it. It didn't make sense to me. It didn't add up. I didn't like the idea that so many of the plays were short to long as opposed to reading deep to short. And so the way I saw the game just didn't mesh with the West Coast offense. And you sit back and go, my gosh, it made how many quarterbacks, Hall of Fame quarterbacks, great quarterbacks, MVP quarterbacks in this league, but it just didn't mesh with how I saw the game and how I like to read the game. And so then I got together with Mike Martz, and he always had touchdown options in every play. And we were trying to push the ball down the field, and we were always trying to be aggressive, and that fit me perfectly. That's who I was. So why we had so much success so quickly was because we saw the game the same way. And that to me becomes the first part of the process, is not just taking plays that they had in Detroit and going, oh, this play worked really, really well for Jared Goff. We're going to run that here. It's sitting down with Caleb and going, how do you see the game? What makes sense to you? You know, what did you struggle with last year? Because they probably had some similar plays in Detroit that they ran in Chicago, but Caleb may have struggled with it. Why did you struggle with it? What don't you like about this? And getting an understanding of how they each see the game and then being able to try to mesh that vision point together is to me the most important thing, because just because it's worked and just because one quarterback likes it doesn't mean the next one will, and they'll be as comfortable in it. And so it's finding an offense and building an offense that both guys are extremely comfortable with. And sometimes you're going to have to make concessions. Now, I remember when Ken Wisenhunt came to Arizona, and he came from, you know, the Pittsburgh background, which was a tight end, a fullback, under center, a lot of play action, drop back type stuff. And I felt I could do that, and I had done a lot of it, but our team wasn't built that way. We didn't have a great tight end. We didn't have a fullback. We didn't have a power running game, so we had to become kind of a three, four wide system because of who we were, and that obviously fit my skill set. And so we were constantly, you know, massaging our offense to fit both of us. There was a game in Chicago, I still remember to this day, where we ran what we call kind of a post-corner route. And it was more out of the play action, two wide receiver type set. And, you know, all week long, I told Coach, I'm like, I don't like this play, Coach. I don't like it. I don't like throwing it. I don't like having that as my only option. And he had to say, just trust me, Kurt. Like, this one's me. This is one that I like, and here's why. And so there was the give and take. We called it in the game. I threw a touchdown to Larry Fitzgerald, you know, walked over to the sideline, and he just had that smile on his face like, see, sometimes you got to trust me, because sometimes you don't see it exactly like I do, but trust what I see, and then vice versa. And so that's the kind of massaging and the back and forth that goes on to building an offense that fits both of their vision and allows both of them to be the best version of themselves.
Well, that's the dream, is that Ben Johnson could have enough in his back pocket, enough knowledge that he builds it. And that's what he said. So I love that. It in that regard, Jared Goff spends a lot of time under center, man. I don't have the data for this year. Maybe you do, but for 2023, it was Goff and Kirk Cousins were the most under center, far and away, of any quarterbacks in the NFL. Is Ben Johnson going to make Caleb Williams go under center more? Should he?
Well, yes. I mean, I'm just a believer that you got to be able to do everything. Like, as a quarterback, yeah, you got to be able to take snaps under center. You got to be able to play the game under center. And it's one thing when, you know, when I start working with young quarterbacks, whether I was coaching in high school or just doing it on my own, I always have them start their drops and everything from under center. Learn how to do that, because it's still an important aspect of the game, whether it's, you know, beneficial to the run game, whether it's beneficial to play action, whatever that is, you have to be able to do that. And you have to be comfortable with that. And so I hope so. I mean, I hope Caleb can get comfortable with it, and I hope they use it, because you want all that stuff in your playbook and you want to be able to be comfortable with that. And so, yeah, maybe he hasn't been comfortable with that in the past, but to me, I think it's really, really important to do that.
Kurt, as always, we appreciate your time and your expertise. Thanks so much for joining us.
You got it. Good talking to you guys.
Thanks, Kurt.
Same. I like when we get to talk ball with Kurt Warner.
Oh, yeah, man.
I love that matches. We can play with it tomorrow, but that matches what Ben Johnson was saying. And that's why he wants Caleb to get into a room. Because I think he even said, like, he has to see what I see.
Right. They have to match. They have to have the same vision.
So, I mean, it makes me feel really good that he's saying stuff that Kurt Warner is saying out of instinct, out of his history.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it can work. I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. I think he very much liked the hire. Our next guest, I'm not so sure. Joe Cowley is going to join us, and we're going to talk about Bulls. We always drift into a little bit of football because Joe loves to talk ball, and he loves to troll you. He'll do that next here on The Score.
Dan Bernstein.
Eventually, they stop growing.
Marshall Harris.
I've stopped growing physically, but not mentally, I hope.
That's a lovely sentiment.
Yeah.
Of course, we're all trying.
I'm just here to grow with you guys.
The Bernstein and Harris Show.
At our place, we're really trying to grow the man.
Middays 10 till 2.
There goes the runner. Fly ball down the right field line. Tucker comes on. Kyle Tucker. This time they finish the job. The Houston Astros, world champions.
Well, yeah, we heard all about Kyle Tucker, but how about the guy getting the save, the guy making the pitch that is results of the ball that's caught by his now current teammate Kyle Tucker? Because that other guy, Ryan Pressly, deserves some credit too, and we welcome him now to the Bernstein and Harris Show on the Score Hotline that is brought to you by Circa Sports Illinois. Download the Circa Sports app today. Ryan, thanks for joining us.
Man, thank y'all for having me.
Ryan, just take us through this process. I know it has been a process. You're a guy with a no-trade clause, and you waived it to come and join the Cubs and take over that closer role, which they badly needed, having blown 26 saves last year. What was your process as far as thought and getting this done so that you could become a member of the Cubs?
Yeah, you know, obviously it was a very difficult decision, you know, leaving Houston. This is where, you know, my family's at, is where we live. You know, had a lot of success here. Fans were great here. Teammates were awesome. You know, organization was great. I just, you know, opportunity presents itself and you get a chance to go pitch in one of the more historical ballparks and put on a pretty historical uniform. You know, you don't get those opportunities very often. And when it came about, you know, I long, hard conversations with family and friends, and you know, we ultimately decided that this is something that we wanted to pursue.
Yeah, Ryan, that's actually something that Jed Hoyer has talked about quite a bit over the past month or so, is the biggest selling point you haven't experienced yet, and you won't until the season gets underway. It will not be in April. As a North Texan, I can tell you that right now. It's definitely going to be in like May or June when you're able to close at a packed house at Wrigley in nice weather and experience what it's like to have that, you know, multiplier of emotion. I know you get limited experience at the ballpark now, just being in the American League, but coming here, you know, what did he tell you about that, and what can you picture about that experience happening?
Well, I think the three times that I pitched in Wrigley, one of it was like an absolute heat wave that came through and the umpire had an ice towel around his neck, and the other times have been absolutely freezing. But, you know, playing in Minnesota for 5 years, you know, I know how to pitch in the cold, and hitters tend to don't really like to hit in the cold either, so that's also nice. But the summer, you know, up there in Chicago, as you guys know, is unbelievable. And, you know, you get a chance to get out of the Houston heat in the summer, you might want to take it a little bit, I guess. But, you know, I'm excited to be up there. You know, I'm excited to meet everybody. I'm excited to see the fans, see what the organization has to offer. And, you know, I've heard nothing but amazing things about it, and, you know, from post and past players. So it's going to be really fun, and I can't wait.
What, if any, guarantee did you get about being the guy to get the saves? Or are you knowingly signing up for a very modern approach to high leverage versus low leverage, and that if you are trusted to clearly be an important getter of outs, that those outs may come in the fifth or the sixth or the seventh?
You know, obviously, postseason is completely different, right? It doesn't matter who pitches what role. As long as you get 27 outs with a win, that's all that really matters. But leading up to the postseason, you know, I've only talked to Skip one time. You know, I haven't really we haven't really discussed. It was more of an introduction, and I'm sure we're going to get a little bit more into depth whenever we get down to camp. You know, I just, you know, they told me that I was, you know, going to be the ninth inning role, but, you know, in my mindset, I'm going to go into camp competing for that role, because you obviously know everything is not guaranteed in this game. So I just want to have that mindset going in there, just of competing and always competing. So again, in the long run, I just want to help this team win. And, you know, the goal is to not just win the division, but the entire thing. And, you know, the experience that me and Tuck can bring, you know, Dansby's been there as well, winning a World Series with the Braves. So we have some guys on this team that have been there and done it. And I think, you know, just adding more of us to that clubhouse is, you're going to bring that culture there. And once you get that culture established, then it's going to be a hard team to beat.
I know we just mentioned Jed Hoyer's name too, but Ryan, you as an 11th round pick of the Red Sox in 2007, I'm just trying to draw some lines here. So have you known Jed for a while then?
I don't think our paths really ever crossed. You know, I'm sure obviously he knew of me. I would at least hope so.
Clearly.
But yeah, but you know, in my minor league days, I don't think we really crossed paths. We might have in the hallway, but I don't really remember.
You mentioned guys that you're joining that have World Series experience. I'm just curious, how much, if at all, have you talked to Kyle Tucker about, you know, what to expect in terms of the interactions that you had and trying to figure out if you wanted to come or stay in Houston, and if you've talked to him leading up to that or not since. I'm just wondering what your communication with Kyle Tucker in this process was.
We talked, you know, a couple times, and, you know, I'm sure he was getting bombarded with questions as well and stuff. So, I mean, we both don't – I mean, I guess he knows a little bit more about the Cubs since he was up there for Cubs Fan Fest or whatever it's called. And, you know, I just – again, I just want to – I get a chance and an opportunity to play at a historical ballpark and put on that uniform. So, you know – just to play with Tuck again is always a cherry on top. So, you know, hopefully we can recreate that memory of that last out in the World Series and bring another World Series to Chicago and go to the city and parade.
Ryan, acquiring you and Kyle Tucker signifies that the Cubs are willing to make some moves in order to bolster their team and try to really at least make a run at the division. As you said, like, that's not just the goal here. What was the message that they sent to you about what they were trying to do? Because it means a lot to people watching from a bullpen standpoint, knowing that this is exactly what this team needed.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, with the Cubs, you know, asking me to come there, and, you know, again, it's an opportunity, a great opportunity that I feel like, you know, it's something that me and my family want to experience. And again, you know, I just want to win. I love pitching in the postseason. It's one of the best feelings in the world, especially when you win the whole thing. And I think, you know, this team has an opportunity to do that. And the more experience that you bring in with guys who have been there and done it, the better chances you are of getting deeper and deeper into the postseason. So the fans are great and the stadium's awesome. And I want to see what it's like to pitch in the postseason there. And I think this team has the capability of doing that.
That's what stands out. Your postseason ERA, as good as your numbers are, your postseason numbers are lower. What is it you like so much about being on that stage and being able to perform?
That's a great question. I don't even really know how to answer that. I don't want to give up a run in the postseason.
Nobody does, but you actually do that though. Like, you're good at actually making that part of it happen.
I hate losing. And that's the time that you don't lose. And you do whatever you have to do to make that possible. And, you know, I just wanted to go out there and do literally my very best. And whatever happens is going to happen. And I've been fortunate enough to have some unbelievable guys, you know, play behind me, and some great catchers behind calling my games. So I can't take really any of the credit. You know, it's not like I've struck everybody out in the postseason, but you know, some of the plays that have been made behind me have helped out my career tremendously, you know, with Chaz's catch in center field and Trey Mancini's, you know, diving play at first base in Philly. You know, all these guys that I have playing behind me, you know, the trust factor that, you know, comes in with it, you know, helps me out a lot. You know, when you have trust in your catchers and the defense behind you, you pretty much feel invincible on the mound, and you feel like you can execute your pitches even better. So having that in Houston, and I know for a fact that I could probably have that here in Chicago, I think it's going to be a huge help. And, you know, the postseason experience that I can bring to the younger group, I feel like I can help these guys and get through any kind of the stressful situations that come about throughout the season.
Last thing for you, just looking at some of the FanGraphs data here, Ryan, why did your changeup usage spike last year?
Well, honestly, I think last year I was battling a lot of mechanical stuff, and I'll be the first one to tell you, I wasn't really myself. You know, my velo was down, you know, just things weren't really going my way. And it felt like an upstream battle last year whenever I took the mound. And, you know, I was really just kind of just throwing everything at the wall and just, you know, hoping something would stick. And, you know, whether it be fastball usage going up, slider usage going down, changeup usage going up, you know, I was literally just trying to do anything and everything to put up a zero. And, you know, and when you're battling stuff mechanically, it's even harder. So,
is that fixed?
Yeah, you know, so I've been working with Kevin Poppy all offseason. I feel like we've cleaned up about 99% of it. So I'm excited to get down to camp, throw to some hitters, and really see where we're at. And I'm excited to work with Tommy Hotovy and, you know, bounce some ideas off him. So I'm excited and seeing what these guys can bring to the table and what I can bring to the table and see what we can create.
Outstanding. Well, best of luck, and thank you for joining us today. Ryan, we appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you all for having me.
Thanks, Ryan.
All right, thanks, Ryan.
That is Ryan Pressly of the Chicago Cubs.
I mean,
to communicate to him the winning side of Wrigley, not the pitched on the Twins side or the Astros side.
Well, it,
I won't ask about
and like
the White
you say,
Sox.
There are a few feelings in baseball, like being the guy on that mound on one of those days at Wrigley when the emotional amplifier is turned up to 11.
Jed said that was the biggest selling point. He's like, they have not. Well, he was talking about Tucker at the time, but he's like, those guys, if you haven't been here, you haven't been able to experience being on the home team and having that yet. You know, so that'll be fun to watch.
I like also that he's prepared because Minnesota won, but also he said it was really, really hot and it was really, really cold the times he's pitched at Wrigley. Nothing in between.
So I know. Minute Maid is such a nice little air conditioned.
Yeah, we'll just keep the roof closed
luxury.
Most of the time.
Well, yes. I don't want to hear it from the Cubs this year about how the wind direction made their offense bad. And we know that last year was a little strange weather-wise and that they're trying to harvest as much data as they can.
But both teams deal with that, right?
I know that. There was a lot of muttering going on, you know, on the record and off the record.
If that's what we're doing.
There's a lot of stuff about how this park is playing more like a pitcher's park than a hitter's park, depending on the wind currents, etc. So there are a lot of people who think about Wrigley Field as just this bandbox because of the famous days there. But it like you say, Layla, April and into May and late, it does not play like a hitter's park.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things about the marquee broadcast that they do is you map the wind. And even in the ballpark, it's different in different areas, as we know.
There was a question asked earlier that we thought, that's one way of looking at it. And the question is this. If indeed the Bulls trade Zach LaVine, understanding his current status as a max player, a multiple-time All-Star, climbing all of your all-time great lists, would Chicago be trading as far as current standing relative to their sport? Is he the top athlete?
The most, I think, is he the most successful athlete that they'd be trading?
And what would the comps be? Like, how often has somebody of his status and his stature been dealt like this? I think you probably count it on one hand. So we'll discuss that next on The Score.
Hey, John Boy, how's the weather?
John Morosi.
JP can provide some clarity as to what went on. JP.
Bob, I will do my best.
Columnist for MLB.com.
Morosi. Where is Jeff Passan in all of this?
Here's John Morosi.
Where is Jeff Passan?
Should we just call Jeff Passan right now?
Yes, just call him.
Fox Sports baseball contributor.
JP Morosi had it first. How you feeling, Padres fans?
MLB Network insider.
What I was told yesterday from sources is that one team to watch and the potential of moving Dylan Cease, the Chicago Cubs.
Ooh.
John Morosi.
I'm so happy, I can't lie to you. It's the best moment of my life. All the fans who are here supporting me means the world.
Sources confirm that fun.
With Spiegel and Holmes on 670 The Score.
Let's go out to the Circa Sports Illinois hotline. You should download the Circa app today to talk a little bit of baseball with John Morosi, who joins us here on the Spiegel and Holmes show. John, thanks for joining us. I wanted to start with the Luis Robert smoke. Is that real?
Well, I do think that the White Sox remain open for business. The essential truth of where they're at as an organization right now has not changed since the end of the season or the start of the winter meeting. So I would say the White Sox continue to engage on him, but we heard the report recently about the conversations between the White Sox and Reds about him. It didn't seem like it went anywhere. I do believe he is still available. A number of teams are still looking for outfielders. And the one thing that I would say that could help the White Sox eventually move Luis Robert is very few teams are completely content with their situation in center field. Very few. And yet, having said all of that, he's coming off of a down year relative to what his full potential is. I would say at this point, unless someone really overwhelms you or unless there's an injury in spring training, you start the season with them. You hope that he has a better first half. And then because of how crowded the middle part of the standings tends to be, and we expect the White Sox to be at the bottom of the standings again, take advantage of the fact that you can be an early seller. And if he has a good first 2.5 months, it's a better trade, I think, for the White Sox in June than it would be right now.
Interesting. Before I want to ask you another one about that, but I got a comment because you're on Twitch. The off-season beard is solid, in my opinion. What do you think, Lawrence? It's a little inconsistent, but that's okay.
I don't know if we needed to rag on it being inconsistent. I like it, John. Is this going to be a lifestyle change for you?
Great question.
That is a great question. So, Lawrence, it has been, and Speaks, thanks for noticing it. It has been a big topic of discussion around the Morosi household.
Sure.
I'm 42 now. Look, I'm not cool. I'm not fooling anybody. But between my wife and my daughters, you know, there's probably a 50-50 split if it's a good idea or a bad idea. I do know this, that it's probably going to have to go away around opening day. But let's at least take a look at it and see where it stands in the latter part of March before we judge it too harshly.
Yeah, but you don't know. By the time opening day comes around, that beard could be in the best shape of its life.
It could be. Yeah. I'm going to be sending dispatches out during the course of spring training that the beard is in the best shape of his life. And by the way, I'm playing in a charity hockey game tomorrow. I feel like the facial hair.
Oh, sweet.
With that vibe.
Yeah, that's a charity hockey beard.
What charity are you playing for?
So it's the Shocks and Saves game. It's in Saginaw, Michigan. Yuri Fisher went into cardiac arrest about 20 years ago in a game for the Red Wings. And fortunately, his life was saved because there was a defibrillator at the side of the ice in Joe Louis Arena. So Yuri Fisher, he's doing well now. He's able to skate. Of course, didn't play after that competitively, but his health is good. And so he's out there on the ice tomorrow before the Saginaw Spirit game. And we're going to be, I'm going to be joining a team of, there's going to be a handful of ex-NHLers there, which makes me a little nervous. And then doctors and first responders, which I feel a little bit better about. And so I'm going to be surrounded by former pros and life-saving people, and then me. So we'll see how we do.
That is excellent. We know of your passion for hockey. That's beautiful that you're taking part. John Morosi here with us on the Spiegel and Holmes Show here on 670 The Score. So last offseason, the Dylan Cease rumors were hot and heavy. And with 2 years left on his deal, John, and then we got to March and they decided they didn't want to risk him actively starting the season because of the fear of injury, and they made the deal in the middle of March for whatever they could get. And it strikes me that this Robert rumor could be Sox floated to try and get the interest up and keep it going. And I wouldn't be shocked if Luis Robert is dealt in March, just like Dylan Cease was.
Yeah, that's a fair point. And that also allows for the psychology of where we are at right now relative to spring training starting. Guys, we are 2 weeks away from pitchers and catchers. And so when you get this close and you're having your meetings, unless you can get someone like Bregman or Alonso at a complete discount, your general default is, hey, let's take a look at what we've got internally before we make some choices about how much money we're going to spend or a trade that we're going to make. It's worth noting, we are still about 3 weeks away from the one-year anniversary of when Bellinger signed back with the Cubs. 3 weeks away from that still. So we've got some significant road ahead of us in terms of the journey from now until opening day. It's still 2 months. That's a long time. And for me, for someone in Robert's situation who has faced questions about consistency in the past, for him, if he wants to find himself on a winning team, if you want to be a Philadelphia Philly at some point in time this year, I know they were linked a bit last year. They made some different moves. They brought in Max Kepler. But the point being, if you want to get yourself to a championship organization now, the best way that Luis Robert Jr. can make that happen is by showing up in great shape, staying healthy, and being a pro in every sense on off the field. And because the scouts are going to be watching, no matter what happens, he is one of those people that I think in spring training, if you feel like you can get him at something of a discount, a talent like him, who objectively might be one of the most 10 or 15 most talented players in the world, when he's right and when he's going. So I think that the way in which he shows up to camp and the professionalism he takes through spring training will be closely watched by a lot of scouts in the Cactus League.
John, what do you think of the Cubs taking advantage of the Astros trying to get underneath the CBT?
Well, I think that, so a couple things. The Tucker deal, I thought that worked out really well. And of course, then the Presley deal was the second one. So it was obviously a two-parter, if you will. I like it. It would not surprise me if eventually from Houston's side of things, it leads to Bregman going back home, so to speak. But I think that Presley was an excellent buy low by the Chicago Cubs. I am a big Ryan Presley fan. There are not a lot of pitchers active in the major leagues right now who know what it's like to throw the last pitch of a World Series. And Ryan Presley does. He has been in the middle of a lot of different postseason situations. He has been in some big moments. There's a reason why when Mark DeRosa had a chance to name anybody his closer, any American-born relief pitcher could have been the closer on Team USA, he chose Ryan Presley. That says a lot about the amount of confidence people have in him. I thought last year he handled the change of role because of Hader arriving with about as much professionalism and grace as you could have expected. And now he's right back where he belongs in the ninth inning. He's got Tucker there with him. I just think it was a phenomenal move by the Cubs front office. And we'll see if there might be one more move to come with Dylan Cease, potentially. I heard the Cubs on him in the last 24 hours here or so. But I think in general, the Cubs did a very good job of being opportunistic and making some really smart moves after the first of the year.
So you mentioned it, Dylan Cease possibly back to the Cubs. This is the rumor, but they were also asking about Michael King out there, right? So they're still sniffing around. Their level of activity is what interests me right now, because they're not a complete team, and it sounds like they know it at the very least. Do you think they have a shot at Cease?
They do, because the number that I mentioned this morning on MLB Network, they've got 7 of the top 100 prospects in the industry right now, Spiegs. That is a massive number, and gives you some ability to acquire talent, bring it in. You think about the relative disappointment that last year was for the Cubs. I think they've already had a winning offseason to date, and if they bring in someone like a Dylan Cease on top of Tucker, on top of Presley, you've got to love that, I think, if you're a Cubs fan, especially when you still have plenty of currency left in your farm system to either call guys up or make trades during the course of the season. I tend to think that Shaw's going to get a chance to win a job on this team, and therefore he will not be part of a theoretical Dylan Cease deal. But look at the outfield, and whether it's Owen Casey or Alcantara, all of them can't play. At some point, you need to look at who you've got and say, let's go for this. And I think show a little bit of urgency in year two with Craig Counsell in what I would describe as a very winnable division. The big picture point here, guys, is this. The same teams that we heard linked to Juan Soto at different points of that courtship and then other high-profile free agents, Corbin Burnes comes to mind, a lot of them are big market teams who have control of their own TV networks and therefore are a little bit, I stress, immune to some of the more existential questions about revenues of the game. Dodgers, Yankees, Mets, Blue Jays, and yes, the Chicago Cubs. They are in that select group of a half a dozen teams who know who they are. The Cubs know who they are, what they're supposed to be, and getting Dylan Cease with even 1 year left on his deal would be a big market move by a big market team who needs to show to everybody, especially in their own market, that is who they are still.
Well, the Cubs fans are going to jump up and support John Morosi in the next baseball election with that one. You know, it's an interesting thing, John, because 2 years from now, when the collective bargaining agreement expires, I think there's people within the Cubs that feel like we're looking at a stoppage, maybe even a skip, and a complete reordering of the institution's financial balance. Do you fear that in 2 years?
I don't, because of a couple things. We've been able to, so salary caps have been in vogue in pro sports for about 30 years now in various forms. And we have negotiated, the people in charge of the sport have negotiated CBAs repeatedly without having to have a salary cap. There are ways to balance the playing field here without a hard cap. You could have a floor. You could have a floor instituted that would then also balance some different things with respect to salary arbitration. There is a solution here that does not require a cap. And part of that, Spiegs, is this. We have just seen in the last two winters, the Soto deal and the Ohtani deal. How could you, with those two contracts, just taking those two, for example, still so early in their life cycle, impose a cap on teams that have those contracts? How would you even make the math work? Would you say, okay, so Soto and Ohtani, you all have to take a 25% haircut on what your deal says it's worth because we've got to increase the minimum salary? I don't see how that happens. I really don't. It makes it, to me, unnecessarily complicated. Do I think there's going to be a contentious negotiation? Yes, but there was one last time, and they found a way to get through it without losing games. I think the way that this gets trickier, and what I will be watching carefully, is how much cohesion is there among the owners, and how much is there antipathy towards the Dodgers for what they have done, or Steve Cohen for what he is doing. And is it basically 2 versus 28, or two versus Yankees, Cubs, other large market teams, another line, and then the mid-market teams, and then the Marlins at the bottom. How do we look at this? So if that is all cleaved up and you've got so many different agendas, yeah, then I would get a little bit concerned. But we have seen some pretty contentious CBAs negotiated without having to lose games, and I am optimistic that's going to happen here again after 2026.
John, this was excellent. Thanks so much for joining us. We truly appreciate it.
Thank you. I'll call back about how the beard's looking by the time pitchers and catchers report, Cactus League starts. I'll keep you guys updated.
Challenge the comfort zone, John, and use the beard for some of those spring training reports.
I am not cool. I am not rugged, but hey, it's fun.
Change up the look? It's totally okay. That is John Morosi, and we thank him so much for joining us. Speaks in the next segment, at some point we should get back to the baseball stuff, even if it's tomorrow, because the Cease and the Robert thing are
there's a lot
fascinating.
There's a lot there with both of them. I agree.
But in the next segment, I am struggling and I need you to help me with something.
Okay.
Something NFL wise. There's something that happened that is really good, but I don't like it aesthetically.
Mm-hmm.
And the NFL is trying to tell me
that you should.
That I should. And it brought about good things. Still don't like it. I'll go through it and get some help from my therapist and apparently my agent, Matt Spiegel. Next, here on The Score. Billy, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it. Listening to you and Speed just go old school Big East has been enjoyable here throughout the break.
Even like old school high school stuff, because I was like a Big East high school kid, a junkie watching those Providence teams with you and Delray Brooks and everything, and it's just like – And then we start talking about all these different players, the guys I saw in high school, whatever, that you know. Does any of that leave your head, Billy Donovan? Like, you came up with Kenny Wilson's name, an old Villanova guard you played against. You're talking about playing against Kenny Smith in high school. It's got to be fun to have all that stuff rolling around, but does it get to be too much rolling around your head, do you think?
Well, I mean, you brought it all up to me. So, I mean, it certainly jogged my memory and a lot of experience I had. So, certainly it was a great time, you know, to be able to play during that time. And, you know, still keep in contact with a lot of the people that, you know, I played against or played with during that era. So, you know, coming out of New York, as we mentioned, my senior year was Kenny Smith was a senior. Mark Jackson was a senior. So we all played against each other in high school.
Crazy. So because we were talking about this earlier, Lawrence, you're a finalist for the Basketball Hall of Fame is Billy Donovan this year. And that's for an entire basketball life, right? And that's the right context with which to think about you. Not Billy Donovan Bulls coach or Billy Donovan Oklahoma City coach, but it's Billy Donovan.
Billy the player, Billy the coach of Florida.
All of it. So, I mean, what does that feel like to be a finalist for the Hall of Fame?
Well, I feel very, very blessed and fortunate. You know, one thing I've realized that I've been really, really lucky with throughout my career, one is I obviously great parents, and then, you know, I played for great coaches, which was really, really impactful to me. And then once I did get into coaching, getting a chance to work with Coach Pitino, you know, playing him for 2 years at Providence and then working with him for 5 years at Kentucky. You know, and then the number of assistants I've had both in college and the NBA, I've just been fortunate. I've been around unbelievable coaches and been really, really blessed to coach some just terrific teams and terrific players.
Do you remember kind of the moment when basketball quit being a game for you and became like a life for you when you knew like, hey, this is something I want to keep doing and exploring?
Well, I think like probably most, you know, 21-year-olds, you know, you don't think you're ever going to stop playing, you know, and you know, back when I came out, there was 5 rounds in the draft. So I got drafted in the 3rd round and was drafted by Utah and, you know, was cut by them. I actually played part of the year for the Knicks. I was in the CBA, which is basically would be the G League right now. One of my stints in the CBA is I played for Flip Saunders. So, you know, you never have really a plan when you're playing, you know. And then I actually got talked into coming from, you know, being a New Yorker to go down to Wall Street and try to make money and make a living after I finished playing. And I'm like, you know what? I really do not enjoy anything about this right now. And I just missed basketball, you know. And then Coach Pitino had left and went and took the Kentucky job. And then he, you know, I was fortunate enough, he, you know, offered me a position. It was a graduate assistant position back then. You know, I had to work my way up. And then as there was coaches that left and took different jobs, I was able to kind of work my way up. And, you know, I was always grateful for the opportunity to be able to do that. But I, that's probably the point when I looked to try to take a job down on Wall Street and was working for about 8 months. And was like, there's no way I am doing this for the rest of my life.
And this is still more fun.
Yeah, right? So this is, I just said, you know, and I think for me, it was good at that age to get a chance to at least see the business side of it, because I knew I didn't want to do that. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I'd really missed the game. And, you know, I thought about a lot of people that had coached me over the years. You know, like my senior year in college, you know, it was Rick Pitino, Stu Jackson, you know, who was a Knicks coach, and then wow. coached the Grizzlies, the GM, worked in the NBA office. Gordy Chiesa, who left Providence and went on and was an assistant coach at the Utah Jazz. And a lot of people don't remember this, but, you know, the one person that lived in the dorm with me was Jeff Van Gundy. Jeff Van Gundy coached me in college. So, like, I was always around, you know, all these people. And then my first year, I played with the Knicks. Rick Carlisle was a teammate, and we became very good friends. So, like, I was just always around it. When I got removed from it, you know, as a player, I just felt like, gosh, so many of these people impacted me. I wonder if in some way I could kind of give back that way through mm-hmm. the coaching aspect of it.
When you think about it, now we're talking to Billy Donovan here on The Score at Spiegel & Holmes, live at the United Center, thanks to the Bulls. What kind of lessons has basketball taught you and through you to your family? You know, what has basketball taught you?
Well, I mean, the game has really blessed me in a lot of ways. I think the one thing that, you know, I've always taken from the game is, you know, it's a team sport and there's a lot of sacrifice that goes into it, you know, and you've got to be willing to do things that are going to enhance the people around you, you know, your teammates. And, you know, you got to find ways and understand, you know, really what goes into winning. And I think if you break down winning and what winning is, I think you look at those ingredients and qualities and you can apply them to any area in your life. You know, and I've always said this, you know, when you get out of college and you on your own and you know, you get, you know, married, have family, have a job, you're always part of a team, whether it's your team as a family, you know, whether you go to church and you have a spiritual community, you go to work and you have a job community. So I've always just been, you know, a believer that, you know, the lessons of the game can teach you is so many things about sacrifice, winning, making people better, thinking about others, doing all those kind of things. And, you know, how do you enhance the situation you're in to make the people around you better? You know, and I think if you can do that, I think there's an opportunity to be successful in whatever you want to do.
Lawrence and I are setting picks for each other all the time.
That's a good sacrifice right there.
Yeah, right?
Yep, screener's always most open.
That's right. Got to give him the ball back, you know? You got to make sure you take care of those guys. We have been spending a lot of time talking about Lonzo. And I got to admit, I didn't think that he would make it back to the NBA. And not only has he made it back, he plays a gorgeous floor game. But I'm seeing the athleticism return. And I know that you've been asked about this quite a bit throughout the season. But what's this been like to see that guy go from maybe not having a career to being one of your more important players?
Well, you know, I think for a lot of people that watch, you know, games, you see the game and the game ends and, you know, it gets turned off. But, you know, having a chance to be around Lonzo for several years and be around him when he was going through this injury and, to your point, wondering, you know, can I ever get back on the court to play again on a consistent basis, and to see that journey that he had to go through and to see the way he handled it was really, really inspiring in a lot of ways, because he never wavered and he was willing to do whatever he had to do to get back on the court. And there was so many setbacks for him, you know, where he thought he was making some progress and then he'd have a setback, another surgery, and then, you know, when it finally got to the point where he was going to miss basically a year and a half through rehabilitation with the surgery he had, you just didn't know what he was going to look like. And I felt like the first day of training camp when we started playing 5-on-5, he was rusty, the timing wasn't there, but you could just see the IQ and the way he was moving and the way he's passing. And, like, once he gets back to playing, he's going to be fine. Now, the thing that's really impressive to me about him is here's a guy that, without question in his career, has been an NBA starting point guard and probably, when he got hurt, was on the trajectory to be one of the better point guards in this league. To be able to adjust mentally and go from that to now coming off the bench or having to only play a certain amount of minutes and still impact the game, I think speaks to what a truly incredible player he is.
Where's your respect level for him as a person, as a worker? I mean, just looking from afar, mine has jumped as I watch him.
Yeah, I mean, it's it was really moving in a lot of ways. You know, I went out to California quite a bit, you know, in the off season to see him, and I watched him go through rehab and, you know, spend time with him. And, like, you wouldn't know. He was no different during that process than when he was playing, you know. And that's the thing that was so inspiring, is whatever was being thrown at him. And, you know, I'm sure in his dark moments or when he was alone, you're sitting there saying, geez, you know, I've got this career. I'm doing unbelievable. I'm playing great. And now this happens, and woe's me. And he never was that way at all. It was like, okay, you know, what's next? You know, now what, so what, you know, let's just get going forward. And he was driven and motivated to get back and do whatever he had to do to play. And, you know, I think for him, in my conversations with him, he wants to have a career. And he, whatever the role is, he's okay with that. You know, he wants to be able to impact a group and impact a team. And that's the one thing we talked about earlier, is he's one guy that you look at, he makes people around him better. And I'm just really, really happy for him, you know. And I felt bad earlier in the year when he sprained his wrist. You know, we were lucky it wasn't worse. But for him, it's like, okay, another setback, right? And he just kind of marched right through that as well and got himself back on the court. And, you know, he's played really, really well considering the amount of time he's missed.
And he's clearly the stable big brother. Like, LaMelo is wild and flashy and fun and exuberant, and LiAngelo is now a multi-million dollar rap star. Like, he's that stable force in the family, and he probably is on a court too.
Yeah, I don't know the brothers that well, but you know, Lonzo, when you do talk to him, he is, you know, mature beyond his years, you know, in a lot of ways. And he's a guy that's very, very quiet, but if you take time to really ask him a lot of questions, his level of intelligence and how smart he is just about things in the game of basketball is really amazing.
How would you say your relationship has evolved with Zach, and Zach's relationship with the team evolved since you've been here?
You know, I don't know all that had transpired, but the one thing that I felt like this year coming into the media day was his response to things. And, you know, he made some comments that, you know, he's had time to reflect. He's had time to really evaluate and review, and he is going to be all in and do whatever he can to help the team. And I've always felt like my time with Zach in the summers, after the season's over with, he's always taken time to reflect on the season and try to figure out ways to get better. And, you know, I don't think this summer was any different from him. He's a great guy. I really, really enjoy being around him. I think he's got great relationships with his teammates. But I do think, you know, some of the things that happened the last, you know, 2 years for him, it was a lot for him to handle. But I think the way he came out of it on the other side is really impressive, of what he learned from all of that, what he took from all of that, and how it's actually made him better and how he's utilized that to help himself.
One more thing, because we know you got to do your press conference. I just wanted to ask you about Io. And we love to talk about mentorship here. We love to talk about coaching when it goes right. When Io first got here, you were coaching him hard. You know, I'd see you at practice, and I'd be like, man, Io is out here getting coached. How satisfying is it for you as a coach to see a player like that make it to their second contract?
No, when you're with somebody for a period of time and you can see that evolution. You know, it's like the same thing with Modest right now at 19 years old. You know, he needs that. He just is not coming in here with a wealth of experience, which he shouldn't be. But, like, learning and understanding what he's got to do to impact the game and impact the team. And, you know, the thing with Io that I always admire is he really wants it direct. You know, he wants it truthful, and he wants it raw, and he wants it right in front of him. And everybody's a little bit different, you know, and that's the way he is. And, you know, he doesn't shy away from challenges. He's a great competitor. I do think he got humbled his second year. You know, that when Lonzo and Alex Caruso went down his rookie year, and then he got thrusted into the starting lineup, I think he surprised everybody that first year. And he kind of kept us afloat, you know, having two guards out. That next year, I think he thought, okay, I know what I got to do. I know what this is all about. And then as there's more film and information out there on you, you have to adjust, and you've got to adapt, and you've got to learn, you got to grow. And I think for him, he's like, you know, I've done this before. I know exactly what I got to do. So that second year wasn't nearly the kind of year he wanted to have. And then you could just see a switch flip in him that last summer with the amount of time and the investment he made to try to get better and improve in areas with the way teams were defending him and how they were guarding him. And he knew he had to get better in pick and rolls, in decision making with the ball. And I give him all the credit because he just kind of forged forward and really, really worked hard.
So, Billy, my grandfather had a furniture store, and then my dad and my uncle ran the furniture store. And then it became clear that nobody in the next generation was interested. So I'm not running the furniture store.
Yeah.
How's the family business going with your son in the G League? Like, what is this like for you?
Well, a lot of times it's a crossover. Like, we play when they're playing and stuff, so we don't really see each other. Sometimes I get a chance to go out there and watch them play. I'm happy for him, you know, because it's something he loves doing and wants to do, and it was totally his decision and his choice. And, you know, he's... The one thing I wanted to do for him is I wanted to make sure that he had to go through the hard road and he just wasn't given anything, you know. So he was a JV high school coach. He was a varsity high school coach. He went in and was the last assistant on the G League team with San Antonio Spurs. He was doing travel. He was washing uniforms, you know. Because I think when you do that, you find out whether or not you want to coach or not, you know. So he kind of went through it there a little bit. Now, it's probably a little more difficult to my wife going through two seasons at the same time and, you know, living and dying with every game. But I'm happy for him because he really loves doing what he's doing.
And you need that person to be implementing your vision in some ways. It's got to be helpful in that regard.
It is. You know, the one thing that's hard there, I think, with the G League is you want to have very similar terminology. But the other thing that's a little bit of a problem is, you know, like our personnel is totally different from his personnel. So when you sit there and say we're going to run the same exact offense that the Bulls run, well, that may not fit with his team. So I've always told him, like, you got to put the players in the best position that they can showcase their skills. Don't worry about what we're running. Defense is a little bit different, you know, because you can kind of keep it somewhat similar. But offensively, I think for his growth as a coach, he's got to figure out, how do I use the personnel, you know, to the best of our team's ability, and how do I go about doing that? So, you know, again, I'm always available for him. I don't really stick my nose in it too much. If he needs help, he'll ask and he'll talk to the coaches. But you know, they just got back from a road trip, and I think that they go back on the road here again soon.
Billy, we always get smarter when you talk basketball. Thank you so much for joining
us. My pleasure. It's great to be with you guys.
Thanks,
Thank you,
Billy.
Kendall, good morning. How are you?
I'm good, guys. How about yourself?
Doing well.
You know, we had an interesting conversation this morning where we were talking about the trade deadline. And, you know, obviously, that's kind of what's next here is what happens at the trade deadline. We look around the league and we see all the things that are lined up, all the rumors that are floating around out there. How, you know, the problem with the Bulls and trading someone is if indeed they kind of bite the bullet and do that, and they've got guys with expiring contracts, so it would make sense. They can preserve the draft pick, and that would be a win, but I don't know that that's enough. I don't know that you'd get much. It's almost like you're going to lose whatever trade you make because of the situation that you're in as a team.
Yeah, I'm right with you on that one. I mean, I'm not going to make a trade just for the sake of making a trade. You know, the way that Zach and Vooch have played this season so far, I mean, they're going to, of course, warrant interest because those guys have all-star numbers. You know, I thought actually Zach possibly had an outside shot to make the all-star team. Unfortunately, because of our record, this season he did not make the team, but he's been right there with all of the top guys in the league. So has Vooch, especially in the Eastern Conference. He's been one of the better big men, and I know that there's several teams looking to add guys like that to their roster, especially teams that are trying to make a run at the championship, specifically the Milwaukee Bucks, the Denver Nuggets. You know, the Golden State Warriors have expressed interest in, mm-hmm. in Nikola Vucevic. But it all depends on, you know, what we're going to get back. I mean, are you going to give me an all-star caliber player back, or a young player that has potential to be an all-star? That's really the only way that I'm going to make a trade. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, we should tank, and, you know, we should try and go for the draft pick, you know, getting the Cooper Flagg sweepstakes or the Ace Bailey sweepstakes. Well, you know, I actually think we already have that guy in Bucelis. You know, Bucelis, all he needs is, in my opinion, he needs more time on the floor. He is 6 foot ten. He does all of the things that those guys down in college do. And let's not forget, he's supposed to be a sophomore in college. Okay, he's a young guy that I believe you can build around, and he's got a world of talent. You know, I thought he was going to be a top five pick, but he fell to the Bulls at number 11, which was a blessing. But you know, you don't know that right now, but in 2 or 3 years, you'll know that down the road because of the development that he's going to have over these next 2 or 3 summers.
That's interesting. I want to get to that in a moment, but Kendall, I understand why. Typically, you don't want to make a trade just for the sake of making a trade. But I do wonder what you think about how much pressure there is on AK to do just that because of his propensity to just stand pat and you're running in place and really not going anywhere that is a clear direction. Do you think that pressure will outweigh what you traditionally would expect? You know, you would be reluctant to make a trade just to make a trade.
Yeah, I mean, I understand the pressure that's on him. I mean, especially, you know, publicly from the fan base saying that, you know, we're going to be a perennial play-in team and, you know, we're tired of being in this position. But, you know, you got to do what you think is right. I mean, and AK has always stuck with his guns. I mean, this has been his history since before he came to the Bulls. You know, he doesn't really make a lot of moves that don't make sense. And, you know, they may make a move. I mean, I don't know whether it'll be one of the core guys. It might be, you know, one of the guys. I mean, perhaps Kobe White is in play. I mean, I think that the only untouchable guy on this roster really is Bucellis right now. You know, I mean, I've heard rumors about Kobe White, even though, you know, I think Kobe is still a very important part of this team. I'd hate to see if any of these guys be traded, but I understand the business. This is what it is. But we just have to wait and see. We got about, a week or so left? Mm-hmm. So we will see. I know it's a nervous time for the guys, though. I mean, everybody, if I was anybody in the NBA, I'm not buying real estate right now.
What's fascinating to me is, like, the Warriors are considered, you know, a team that's in play. The question is, are they trying to get Jimmy? Are they trying to get Zach? Are they trying to get Vooch? And then you look at the Suns, and they've collected draft picks. Who are they trying to get? And what's your take on the whole Jimmy thing, everything that's going on down there? You know, I hate when a guy is, you know, just – I hate when a guy is forcing himself out of town and it looks like he's not going to be able to happily go back there after having a pretty good run there.
Yeah, I mean – I don't understand that, but that's been the history of Jimmy. I mean, I think, you know, Jimmy's been entwined in these type of relationships with the Bulls, with the Timberwolves, somewhat with the 76ers, and now the Miami Heat. And you know, he's got to understand he's 35 years old. You know, he's in the twilight of his career. He's still a very capable player, but you know, teams are not going to tolerate this type of behavior when you're long in the tooth. Yeah, he's still, in my opinion, an all-star caliber player, still capable of carrying a team. But, you know, at some point you got to realize things have changed and you can't behave like you're 23 years old. I mean, because sometimes teams will put up with that stuff, you know, when you're a younger player and you got a long time. But You're doing that once again, and then on top of that, you're doing it to Pat Riley, you know. And I played for Pat Riley for one season. This guy doesn't play around, man. You know, if you screw around with him, he's going to try and find a way to get rid of you. And you know, not to a team that you want to go to. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if the Miami Heat tried to send him to Utah or Portland or something like that.
So, Kendall, that would serve him right, actually, for talking his way out of another town. So, back to Bucellis, because I think your perspective on him is interesting, and especially in light of what we heard from Billy Donovan less than a week ago, I thought very candid, and he's been very honest and open about what Matas Bucellis is and what he isn't yet. And he talked about not being ready for 30 minutes a game. And so the idea that this remainder of the season should be devoted to developing your rookie first round draft pick, he didn't sound like any minutes, all the minutes are always good minutes, and that there are limitations defensively that you need to protect him against. What do you think about the way that the Bulls are using him and the way that Billy Donovan has explained it?
No, I mean, I agree with Billy as far as the minutes. I mean, 30 minutes a game, yeah, that's too much for him right now. But, you know, I like the way that Billy is bringing him in during crucial situations sometimes, playing him in fourth quarters. And then, you know, he's not finishing games, but he's getting an opportunity to play crunch time with the first unit. And, you know, I just like to see him get more in to play with the starters more. So, you know, he does play with the bench guys that come out, which is good, but I like to see him play with Zach, Vooch, and all those guys to get the experience of what it's like to be a starter. Because, honestly, David, he is the future of this franchise, you know, and if you can build around him and get him those that crucial experience right now, he's going to be better next year and the following year.
I saw him interviewed. I think it was Joe Cowley. This was a clip online, and he asked him a question about that, and he's looking at him, and he just says, elaborate. And then Joe has to change, which is a great word, and then Joe has to change the question a little, and then he says, if I'm not playing against the best players, how do I develop? I need to play against whoever the top players. And I thought, that's a great attitude to have. Whether you're outmanned and whether you're going to get humiliated, you're not worried about that. You just want to get better any way you can.
Look, you know, I've been watching Modest since he's in the seventh grade. Okay, he used to play with the Mac Irvin Fire, the same AAU team that my son played for. So in Phoenix, he used to scrimmage against Modest. And, you know, I've watched Modest for a long time, and he's had this type of attitude throughout ever since he was a little kid, you know. And, you know, the comment that he made before the draft, the kid Richesay, I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, from the number one pick for the Atlanta Hawks. I can distinctly remember when Modest said, listen, he doesn't want to see me. I love that attitude, you know, and that's the attitude that this franchise needs going forward. A guy that believes in himself, a guy that wants to improve, a guy that's going to bring it each and every night. And that's what I see. I mean, did you guys see that dunk he had the other night?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
When he just went straight down the lane, knocked the guy down, went straight down the lane and dunked it. And Nikola Jokic was standing right there. He's not afraid of anybody. You know, and that's what you want. Yeah, I'd rather have a guy that's overly aggressive that I have to say, okay, let's pull back the reins a little bit, than a guy I have to nudge all the time. You know, and that's Vucevic.
Kendall, Northwestern could have used your son the other night against Rutgers. maybe next year. But I think when you see that game, curious what your perspective is. You mentioned prospects. We're talking about development. Ace Bailey had 37 points the other night against Northwestern. He's a guy that is probably top five in the draft. I know it's very early, but we are talking about the Bulls and what's going to happen next. When you talk about Cooper Flagg and what everybody wants next year in him, there are other guys in this draft that are generational. Is he one of them, Ace Bailey?
Yeah, he is. And you know, honestly, I like Ace Bailey to be the number one pick. I like Cooper Flagg. Ace Bailey, Cooper Flagg, Dylan Harper.
Yeah, and Harper didn't play in that game.
Yeah, and Harper didn't play in that game. Those are the top three guys. So, you know, is Harper a generational pick? I don't know, but I think that Ace Bailey and Cooper Flagg possibly could be, because those guys can really change the game. You saw what Ace Bailey did the other day to Northwestern. I mean, 37 points, and he was doing it off in less than two dribbles, which is what a pro can do. So that lets you know that he's ready right now. And, you know, Cooper Flagg, of course, has been – I didn't know Cooper Flagg was going to have such a great year, the great year that he's having. I thought that he would have a pretty good year, but this kid is having an All-American year. And, you know, it surprised me. And Cooper's number one talent is his effort, much like Bucevic. Okay? Their number one talent is that they bring it each and every day and they have a high motor. And that's what you want in your players.
Kendall, if they went to 10-minute quarters when you were playing, you'd still be in the league.
Hey, listen, I don't know about that. I mean, I'm in shape enough to play ping pong right now. So, you know.
What do you think about that, though? What do you think about that possibility?
of going to 10-minute quarter?
Yeah.
Nah, keep it the same.
That's right.
You know, keep it the same. I don't want to see that change because, you know, high school is 8 minutes now. You'll see guys' numbers going down. Guys won't like it. You know, sometimes it's best to just, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Now, you talk about the three-point line, I take corner threes away.
Why would you do that?
So to make the three-point shot more valuable, you know, because I think there's way too many threes taken right now. I mean, what are Boston Celtics average 53 threes a game?
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, I'd like to see some of the mid-range game come back or perhaps move the three-point line back a little bit, you know, to make it more challenging.
Move it on the corner to a point where you're more likely to step out of bounds than actually be in bounds. You could try it, but you'd be on your tippy toes.
Right, exactly.
So back to the Bulls in terms of the trade deadline approaching. Curious what your thoughts are on Lonzo Ball. He's a guy that I think is one of the better stories in the league this year, just what he's overcome to stay on the court. And now he's up to 25 minutes plus. And you almost take for granted the fact that he is in the mix. Is he a guy that, as teams look at, you know, adding for the playoffs, how attractive is he? How risky would that be to trade for a guy like Lonzo Ball?
I don't think it would be too risky at this point because he's shown that he is 100% back as far as his health is concerned. Maybe his skill level probably isn't back to where it was prior to his injury, but it's close. I'm a guy that thought Lonzo would never play again.
Yeah.
And to see him come back and to play at this level is unbelievable. You know, and it makes me think back to, man, and same thing with Derrick Rose. I mean, what if, you know, he hadn't gotten hurt, you know, with DeMar and Zach and Vooch and all those guys. Of course, we were number one in the Eastern Conference until after the All-Star game, you know, prior to his injury. And, you know, the things that he still does, I mean, the way that he can quarterback this team, you know, the way that he gets the basketball to everybody that needs it in scoring position. You know, the team, they totally change when he's on the court. You know, everybody knows that he's the general. They give him the basketball, and he makes stuff happen. And people and the guys love playing with him. So, if I'm on trying to get a veteran guy, a point guard to make me advance in the playoffs, I'm definitely going to look at Lonzo Ball. You know, because he's exactly what you need. And also now his 3-point shot is starting to come around. You know, so it's a great story, as you said, David. And, you know, I wish him well, man. I wish that he hadn't gotten hurt because we'd be talking about a lot of different things here in Chicago for the Bulls.
No doubt about that. I'm curious. The problem with trades always the same, which is the guys you really want to move, their contracts don't allow you to do so. And the guys you don't really want to move, if you're saying that everybody should be available, the guys you really don't want to move are the guys that have the most value because their contracts are easy to trade. So, like, if someone wanted, you know, Kobe to an extent, Io, someone like that, it would be really easy to get a deal done because it's not much money. But it doesn't mean that it makes you any better. And if you want it, like, let's say, and I don't know how you feel about Patrick Williams, but, like, his skill set vis-a-vis his contract makes him very difficult to move. Too many years left.
Yeah, he just signed a new contract. But, you know, here's the thing. The past two games, the way that Billy has used Patrick off of the bench and the way that Patrick has responded, he's had two great games. I don't know, maybe that's the spot for him, you know, being the first option offensively off of the bench. He seems a lot more aggressive. But it's only two games. I mean, it's just a sample size. We have to see how it goes, you know, 10, 15 games, whether this is the role Patrick best fits. And, you know, if he does, I think that's his role going forward. And, you know, hey, listen, I don't mind his contract if he can do the things that he's done the past two games off of the bench for me. If he can do that, I think it's a great value. Because he doesn't have to worry about you know, Zach or Vooch or Kobe or Giddy being the first option ahead of him. You know, when he comes off of the bench, it seems like he says, you know, I'm the first option. I'm going to shoot the basketball. I'm going to be a lot more aggressive. That's what I've seen over the past two games now. Like I said before, if he gives me that type of value, I think the contract is a great value for him.
Great stuff, Kendall. Appreciate
Thanks, Kendall.
Have a good weekend.
All right, guys.